Amen. Thanks, Pastor Rick. How you guys doing this morning? Good. This is the part where I was debating about, you know, welcoming the Seahawks fans back, maybe asking how your Christmas was, but I decided not to do that. Just in case someone might find that offensive, because I love you anyway. I missed you, though. Hey, hopefully you got one of these. Hopefully you saw those back there. We're working through the story. This is the Bible. Go figure. But what's happening there is a group of editors have basically omitted some parts, some of the details, so that we can capture the big story, the big picture narrative of what God is up to in human history. And so we're working through that. You can get it on your electronic device for $4, $3.99 actually. We have some of them back there in the back. So if you don't have one and you want one, I think we paid $7 or $8 for those. If you're able to throw a couple dollars in the box to cover that, awesome. If you don't have $7 or $8 and you still want one of those, please take it. We definitely want you to have one. And even if you're sitting there right now thinking, I should just go back there and grab one, feel free to do that. But I'm not going to use this particular one because I have graduated onto the large print edition. Thanks to Joel and Lindsay. God met my need there. So I'm actually going to use this one right here. So we're in the story. And, you know, one of the things that's really tricky about the Bible is that we tend to learn it in pieces, in fragments. And it's a little bit like, I said this a couple weeks ago, it's a little bit like trying to put a puzzle together without the box. If you just learn tidbits and kind of piece them all together, you might eventually figure out what the big story is, but it's going to take a really long time. Just like putting a puzzle together without seeing the picture. You might eventually stumble on to the actual completed puzzle, but it's going to take a lot more effort. That's how the Bible is, because it really is one narrative, one story from beginning to end. And so that's what we're really focusing on, is capturing the big story. So we started a few weeks ago on the first week of this new year with creation. In the beginning, God, the first four words of the Bible, God creates the universe, the earth, the entire creative order, and everything in it, including humans. And he declares it to be, at the end of all his creating, he declares it to be very good. And of course, if you're familiar with the story, you know it takes until about the second page, halfway through the second page of the Bible, before the antagonist enters the scene. And he deceives the man and the woman into rebelling against God by choosing to say, you know, God, your plan looks really great, but we're going to do this our way instead. And he deceives them in that way. And unfortunately for all of us, things like sin, death, destruction, all of those things enter the world because what once was perfect, what once was very good, is now corrupted. And so it begins a pretty rapid spiral. And by the end of the first week, we arrived at Noah. It says in Genesis 6:5 that God looked out at the landscape of the world and he saw that every intent of the heart of man was only evil all the time. That sounds like a horrible world to live in. We were just talking about this with the band earlier. We were just talking about how, you know, there's a lot of bad things in our world, but there's a lot of good things too. Certainly not every intent of the heart of man is only evil all the time. So when God looked out and said that, it must have been really bad, except for one guy. Things had gone from all good to only one good, and God started over with Noah. It says that God was sorry he had made man. Of course, you might be familiar with the story of the great flood. God basically wiped out the earth except for Noah and his family. And it's interesting that we make that into like a kid's story and put it on pajamas and bed sheets. The greatest catastrophe in history, but nonetheless, that's how it went down. So God reboots. He starts over with Noah. And then the next week we talked about Abram, who became Abraham. And the important part of his story is that Abraham believed God's promise. God promised Abraham that he was going to establish his family and make them into a nation, that his descendants would be as multiple as many as the stars. That's how many descendants he would have. And what's interesting about it, of course, if you know the story, is that God made that promise to Abraham when he was very old. He was not a young man. He and his wife were both well past the age that they would normally have had children, and he had no descendants. But Abraham believed God, and God gave him a son, Isaac, who became the next leader of that family. And Isaac had a son named Jacob, and Jacob had a son named Joseph, who we talked about last week. And Joseph is one of the most incredible stories in all the Bible. He's the youngest of 12, the favorite son, hated by his brothers, and sold into slavery. And in slavery, he ends up in prison through no fault of his own, and he has all these trials and difficult circumstances. But eventually, he's able to do Pharaoh a favor. The Pharaoh of Egypt, he interprets his dreams for him, and through that process, God eventually brings Joseph's story full circle. He becomes the second most powerful person in all of Egypt. And when a famine strikes the land, people come from neighboring countries to buy food from him. And guess who shows up? His 11 brothers. And he's able to save his entire family, the people of God, Abraham's descendants. He's able to save them through this. And God brings his entire struggle full circle. And really the point that we see is that God works everything for the good of those who love him. And Joseph says to his brothers at the end, they're afraid. He's gonna, you know, get retribution on us now. And he says to them, don't be afraid, because what you intended for evil, God intended for good. And that's the story of Joseph. And what we see is that the Bible is beginning to unfold the story of how God is bringing all things back to square one, all good. God is restoring all things. It's beginning to take a little bit of shape now. And what we're seeing is that through all the mistakes and the slip-ups and the rebellion and the sin of humanity, God is still weaving it all together for ultimate good. It's what he did then. It's what he does today. And so if we just think back about those few stories, there really is a good kind of ground level lesson for us right here today in our own lives. It would be easy for us to look at the story so far and say, okay, well, this is the story of how God blesses the people who trust in him. And that's true, but that's only a part of it. It's really the story of how God is blessing the world through those who trust in him. How God's blessing goes beyond just me in my own life when I trust him. God is blessing and redeeming the entire world. He's in that process through those who trust in him. And sometimes I think, well, that's just for the extraordinary and gifted people who do these amazing things. But if you think about the lives of the people we've talked about so far, they're pretty average people. So here we are today. We've arrived at chapter 4. We're at Joseph. We're come to Moses. We're at the end of Joseph's story. You remember Joseph was sold into slavery and became Pharaoh's right-hand man through the famine. And his brothers came to Egypt, and eventually he moved all of his family there so that they could survive the famine, basically. And while they're there, God has promised them that they would be their own nation. They would have their own land someday, but now they're living in Egypt. This is not their promised land that God had promised to Abraham, but they're prospering. They're growing. They're multiplying. Their family is becoming very, very large. There's probably at least thousands of them by now, and they're prospering within Egypt. And so that's where we pick up the story at the beginning of chapter 4 in the story, which is Exodus 1:6. Quite an expanse of time has gone by. They've been there for a while, living in Egypt, and continued for several generations to enjoy the blessing of the Egyptian people. But this is what it says. Now Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died. But the Israelites were still exceedingly fruitful. They multiplied greatly, increased in number, and became so numerous that the land was filled with them. Then a new king, to whom Joseph meant nothing, came to power in Egypt. Look, he said to his people, the Israelites have become far too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous. And if war breaks out, they will join our enemies and fight against us, and then they'll leave the country. So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor, and they built Pithom and Ramses as store cities for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with harsh labor in brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their harsh labor, the Egyptians worked them ruthlessly. So this is the state. This is the situation they're in. There's a new king, a new pharaoh, who doesn't know Joseph. He doesn't know the story of how Joseph saved the entire nation of Israel by interpreting Pharaoh's dreams and protecting them against the famine. And this is where Moses' story begins. They've become heavily oppressed. Moses is a big deal. You don't even have to be in church to know some of the stories of Moses. Moses, of all the things he was a part of, is most known for the parting of the Red Sea, a little crowd participation. And if you Google it, be careful, but there are many, many internet jokes about Moses and the things that he did, including this one where he's parting the water in front of his buddy. You don't even need to read the caption to know what that says. That's what Moses is known for. There was a mom who was on her way home from church with her son, and she asked him about his class. What did you guys learn about? And Moses and the part, you know, and how he saved Israel and led them out of captivity. And she said, really? Well, how'd that happen? So he said, well, you know, they escaped from Egypt, and as they're running away, Pharaoh's army was chasing after them, and they came to the Red Sea, and they were trapped there between the sea and the army. So they set up a pontoon bridge, and they escaped across the Red Sea on the pontoon bridge. And then when the army followed them, Moses called in an airstrike, and the fighters came, and the helicopters came and blew up the bridge, and they were all wiped out. And the mom's like, really? That's not how I remember it. Is that really what they told you? And the kid says, no, but if I told you what they said, you'd never believe it. That's Moses. Okay, Moses is involved with a lot of pretty crazy things. And remember, if you believe the first four words of the Bible, then this is a plausible thing to believe. If you believe that in the beginning God, this is a plausible thing to believe. The miraculous is not unreasonable if you believe that in the beginning God. And if you don't, you probably don't believe anything that came after that. And that's, you know, that's where you are. So yes, that's crazy in my mind. But if I believe that in the beginning God, then it's not an unreasonable thing to believe. And Moses becomes one of the principal figures in all of the Bible through a whole sequence of events. But if you're familiar with your story, you know that he was actually a pretty unlikely hero. He wasn't a person. His ability to lead people didn't come from the place that you might think that it would. So here's how Moses' story begins. At the top of page 44, it says, then Pharaoh gave this order to all his people. Every Hebrew boy that is born, you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl go. Now, it would be really easy for us to think, man, that Pharaoh's a really, like, insecure jerk. And, you know, you'd be right. But something more important is happening at a high level. What the editor of this particular book, the Bible, the story, what he calls the upper story. Something more important is happening than just Pharaoh being a jerk. What's really happening here is the battle between good and evil. That's what's being waged. In the upper story, the battle between God and his adversary is going on. And if God's plan is to build a nation and bring a savior through the Israelite family, through their nation, then what do you think his adversary's goal is? To upset that plan, to exterminate, if you will, that family, that nation. So yes, Pharaoh is a jerk, but that's not really what's happening here. The upper story is something Moses, much more important. So Pharaoh makes this decree, throw all of the Hebrew, all of the Israelite baby boys into the river. Let's get rid of them. And Moses' mom has a good plan. I got to be honest, I don't think she gets nearly enough credit. Like, we think about Moses as being the hero, but his mom was pretty bold. Basically, she hides him for the first 3 months of his life, but eventually he becomes too big and loud to hide, you know, because when they're really little, it's cute when they cry and doesn't really bother anybody, but then they start screaming. And Moses finally starts screaming, and she can't hide him anymore. So her plan is, she remembers that Pharaoh's daughter goes down to the river to bathe on a daily basis. She's down there probably with her entourage. And so she takes a basket and covers it with pitch or tar or something like that and puts him in the river along the reeds. And her hope is that Pharaoh's daughter will see him. And she does, and she sends her attendants over to retrieve the baby. And she decides she wants to keep him. Now, that might sound like, wow, that's amazing providence of God, and it is, but it's also not unreasonable, right? Because every person in here disagrees with Pharaoh's decree to terminate the Hebrew baby boys. Like, we all think that's a bad idea. We all disagree with him. Not surprising that his daughter does too. So she takes him home and says, Dad, I want to keep him. And Pharaoh makes a classic blunder. He makes the same mistake that we see God's adversaries make throughout the story. He thinks to himself, what's one little Hebrew baby going to do? What's one person going to do? I mean, how bad could just one person, I mean, we'll get rid of all the others, we'll just keep this one and it'll be fine. Well, the answer to his question is, one person's probably not going to do much, but God, through that one person, might just save the entire nation. And that's how we see it fold out. There's an important little detail that happens here. When Moses' mother puts him in the water, his older sister hides in the reeds nearby. And when Pharaoh's daughter picks him up, she conveniently pops out and says, "Hey, I got an idea. Why don't I go find one of the Hebrew women to nurse him and take care of him for you?" And so, of course, it's Moses' mom is the person that she goes to get. And the importance of that is that Moses is able to maintain a connection to his people through that incident. His sister plays such a critical role in the story, even though we don't really hear from her again, at least not today. She plays a really important part because Moses ends up living with his own family until he's of age, and then he goes to the palace to live as a prince, to be one of the part of the royal household. And so his sister has a really important role in this. Well, one day, he's a young man now. He's out surveying the work that's happening. The Egyptians have enslaved the Israelites. They're working and building with brick and stone. And he sees an Egyptian soldier giving one of the slaves a hard time. He's beating him. And Moses, as you can imagine, is really conflicted in this situation. And so he just can't take it. He sees the injustice and he just can't live with it. So he ends up actually just rage beating this soldier. And he actually kills him. And he tries to hide the body, but people saw and it got back to Pharaoh. And so through that course of events, Pharaoh wants to execute Moses and he ends up fleeing. He has a runaway to a distant land that, you know, no one ever really goes to, and the people who are on the inside have no idea what's happening in the outside world. And I know what you're thinking. It sounds like North Idaho, but it's not. It's actually a place called Midian. It's a place called Midian. It's in the wilderness. And Moses goes to a place called Midian. He's befriended by a family there, and he works for them. He tends sheep for them, and he seems pretty content to just live out his days in a foreign land as a shepherd and just make that his story. That's where he's at until he has a pretty interesting interaction. On page 45, this is what was happening back in Egypt while he was gone. It says, "During that long period, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out. And their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them." Moses is just content to cruise through life, but something's happening back in Egypt. Something much bigger, something much more important is happening in the upper story, in God's story. He has heard the cries of the people who love him. He's heard the cries of people calling out to them. And so Moses is out tending his flock, and he sees a burning bush. It's on fire, but not being consumed. We don't know what it looked like, but I have a picture of one artist's rendering, which doesn't really appear very well on that particular screen. But just think in your mind, what would that look like to me if I saw a shrub, a bush, a tree? We don't really know necessarily, but it's burning, but not being consumed. That's an odd sight, made odder by the fact that it speaks to him by name. It calls out to him. Now, that sounds a little crazy, I admit, but that's what it says there. And Moses begins a dialogue with God. Not in the same way that, you know, you and I like pray to God, like boom, in the room, person to person. He has a conversation with God. And it says in Exodus 3, 5, and 6, this is what it says. "Do not come any closer," God said. "Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground." Then he said, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." At this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. That sounds pretty insane, I know. But remember, if you believe the first four words of the Bible, that in the beginning God, then it's not unreasonable to believe that this was Moses' This was Moses' exchange with God. So God tells Moses, I've heard the cries of my people, and I'm sending you back to Egypt to set them free. To set them free from Pharaoh. And this is what God said. He said, and now the cries of the Israelites has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now, go. It's a three-word sentence. I love that there's a period after it. Here's what's happening, so go. I'm sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. I heard a guy named Tim Sutherland talking about this exchange that Moses has with God. And he says that when it comes to our response to God, right, how we respond when we feel God leading us to take action on something, he says there's two kinds of people in this situation. There's exclamation mark people and there's question mark people. The exclamation mark people, they don't need a lot of explanation. Like there was a kid when I was a youth pastor who was in my youth group, and he wasn't a Christian when I met him, but he eventually like put his faith in Christ one day, and then the next week he showed up with like 12 of his buddies. Like he didn't have to go through like 101, 201, 301 to decide that he wanted to do something for God. He just went, okay, this has changed me. I'm going to go tell everybody I know. Like that's just, he didn't need the answers. My experience has been there's not a lot of those people. Some of us want to be exclamation mark people. Some of us might even think we're exclamation mark people. But the truth is, most of us, the overwhelming majority, are question mark people. When we feel God pressing us to take an action, we have questions like, what about, like we want to know the plan. We need some answers. We'd like to have a safety net in case it doesn't play out just the way that we'd hoped. What about X? Most of us are question mark people. Now, if that's you, I have good news for you. Moses was a question mark person too, so there's hope for all of us. Moses responds when God himself comes and says, I'm sending you back to Egypt to set my people free. Moses responds with a question. You'd think the burning bush and the face of God would, like, the voice of God would be enough to convince him, but Moses responds by saying, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out? And God responds, I will be with you. Moses is basically saying, yeah, I don't think I can do that. God says, I'll be with you. So then Moses immediately comes with another question before he even really gets a full answer to the first one. Moses says to God in Exodus 3:13, he says, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. And they ask me, what is his name? What then shall I say to them? What if I go and I tell them that God sent me and they say, God who? This question should sound familiar because we use this often. Basically what he's saying is, what if I do what you're telling me and then someone asks me a question I don't know the answer to? Or I just get stuck and I don't know what to do? That's something that hinders a lot of us. But God's answer to Moses is unbelievably profound. Like if you think about it too long in the still of the night, you will wake up a mess if you go to sleep at all. He responds by telling Moses his name, which is a really strange interaction. Moses said to God, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? Then what shall I tell them? And God said to Moses, I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites, I am has sent me to you. It's kind of a weak translation in the NIV. The NIV is not really like a word-for-word translation. It's more of a thought-for-thought translation, which works out really well 99.9% of the time. But most English translations of the Bible will actually say, I am that I am, not I am who I am. Because I am who I am is like, I am who I am is what it is. I am that I am is I am the self-existing one, the one with no beginning, no end, who always was, who always will be. I am that I am. Everything that exists has its being in me, was made for me and through me. And you see throughout the scripture that the meaning of that becomes very, very large. And God says, tell them that I am has sent you. The Hebrew word is Yah. Tell them that Yah sent you. I am. I simply I am. It's powerful stuff. Ponder it too long and you'll go crazy. But Moses says, what if they don't believe me? What if they just won't listen? And so God responds with a couple of miracles. He does Moses throws his staff on the ground, and God turns it into a snake and picks it up and turns it back into a staff. And he tells Moses to put his hand in his pocket, and it pulls it out, and it's covered with leprosy. He puts it back in, and it's whole again. God does a couple of miracles right there, but Moses is still not sure, and so he responds, "Okay, but Mr. Yah, I don't speak very well. I stutter. I'm not really good at, like, leading people and speaking, you know, in public." And God demonstrates a little bit of humor with this question mark person by, like, flipping the tables and responding with questions, which is kind of funny to me. I don't know if it was intentional or not, but God says, "Who gave humans a mouth? Who gave humans speech? Who gives them sight? Is it not I?" He responds with a sequence of questions to Moses' questions. And God says, "I will be with you. I will help you speak." And Moses says, "Yeah, okay. Why don't you find somebody else?" He still doesn't want to go. I get it. He sounds a little pathetic, and it makes me realize, you know what? Sometimes I probably sound a little pathetic to God when I know, okay, this is what the Spirit of God is pressing me to do, but I still have excuses. And Moses is afraid. Fear of failure? Anybody been there? He's concerned that he's not equipped to do the job. And to all of that, God simply responds in Exodus 4:12, "Go. I will teach you what to say." Now, through all of his questioning, there's a fundamental question that Moses is not asking. There's an underlying issue that he's sort of avoiding. Not that anybody, you know, in this room would ever do that, but he's avoiding a bigger question that's got to be more pressing. If I'm in Moses' shoes, there's one question that I need an answer to. One thing standing between me and me taking my place in God's story, and that is, what about the Egyptian soldier? What about the fact that if I go back there, I'm supposed to be executed? What about the fact that I'm a murderer and everyone there knows it? Do you think that could maybe be a little bit of a roadblock for us, God? What about the fact that I had to flee from my life? What about the mistakes of my past? Anyone ever felt that? What about that time when I did that and, you know, nobody really knows now and I kind of like to keep it that way? What about that? This is a difficult tension for us, but it's a really good, just ground level, right here in this room, my life, your life. It's a really good lesson because we're in this weird tension where if I have an overly inflated view of my own goodness, I probably don't think I've ever done anything bad enough to disqualify myself. But if I have an underinflated view of God's grace, I probably feel a lot of shame about the things that I have done. And in both cases, I'm wrong. In both cases, I'm wrong because the truth is every person has disqualified themselves from being used by God through sin. The book of Romans is very clear. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. That's true for everybody, no matter how much goodness I think I have. I have disqualified myself. The only way that we are qualified is through God's grace, which applies to anyone who will receive it, no matter how much sin you have committed. And I think Romans 8:33 answers both the prideful and the ashamed really well. Five words. It is God who justifies. No matter how good you think you might be, you don't measure up. No matter how bad you think you are, God's grace has covered you. It is God who justifies. And so I think about that and I think, you know what? Good thing he's got plenty of grace to go around. I'm sure I'm not the only person in this room who's thankful for that. Because no matter where I'm at on the spectrum of just fully believing in my own goodness and how awesome I am, or being absolutely ashamed of who I am, God's grace has paid the bill through Christ. That's the great news of the gospel, and I'm kind of bummed that we're not going to be to that part for a few months because I just want to carry on about how awesome it is. Nonetheless, nothing is going to justify Moses. Nothing is going to justify me. No amount of knowledge or moral superiority or inferiority. God is the one who justifies. And so at the end of every self-justification and every self-condemnation is the simple fact that we're dependent on God's grace, but he has plenty of it for all of us. It's really good news. And Moses responds, God responds to Moses' objection in Exodus 4:19. He says, "Go, all of those who wanted to kill you are dead." And the important part of that is God doesn't say there won't be any consequences for what's happened, but he does point out something really important to Moses that I think is important for many of us to hear, and that is the mistakes I've made will not disrupt God's story, and they will not undo God's plan for the rest of my life. Those things can't be undone by my mistakes. God's grace has paid the bill, and you know what? There's probably a few people who just really need to grab onto that, embrace that. Take that as God's personal gift to you. The mistakes you've made will not disrupt his plans for the rest of your life. They're not that powerful. He's the one in charge. So Moses goes to Pharaoh. And Pharaoh leads one of the most powerful empires the world's ever seen, okay? Egypt is, at this time, what Rome was in Jesus' time. They ruled the known world. Think about it this way, just for context. By the time Moses is on the scene, the pyramids have already existed for at least 1,000 years. You know, some were older, some were newer, but the pyramids have already been there for 1,000 years. Egypt is established. Egypt rules the known world at this point. So Moses goes to Pharaoh and he says, God wants you to let the Hebrews go. Let the Israelites go. Well, he only has one option how to respond, right? Because these slaves are the lifeblood of their empire, their economy. Of course he says no. There's no reason for him to say yes, for him to relent. And so God's recourse is to send catastrophes, often referred to as the plagues. Probably many of you here have either seen the Ten Commandments and or the Prince of Egypt, depending on, you know, your age bracket there. And God sends these plagues. And if you've seen them on film, you know, it gives you a good visual for it. But when I think about the plagues, I think about, like, oh, this is God roughing up the bad guys, right? Like, he's trying to convince Pharaoh. But something far more significant is happening in the high story, in that struggle between good and evil. One of the plagues, God turns the Nile River to blood. And what's happening here is God is demonstrating his superiority over the Egyptian gods. One of the Egyptian gods was Hapi. Hapi was the god of the Nile. God turns the river to blood, and Hapi is powerless to do anything about it. The next plague, God sends swarms of frogs. And one of the Egyptian gods was Heket. Heket has the head of the frog, but Heket is powerless. No matter how much the Egyptians cry out to Heket, Heket can't do anything. God has overpowered the Egyptian god. And, of course, there's Ra, the sun god, the god of the sun, probably considered by the Egyptians to be sort of the pinnacle, the highest god. God causes the sun to go black for 3 days. And no matter how much they call out to Ra, Ra is silent. And God is essentially showing that he alone is I am. I am God. All of your other Egyptian gods are non-entities. They do not exist. I am God. That's the statement that he's making. And so after several plagues, Pharaoh still won't relent. And there's one final plague. God has demonstrated his superiority over every Egyptian god except for one, Pharaoh, who is believed by them to be the son of the gods incarnate. He himself believes that he is a god. That's part of their system. And so God through Moses warns Pharaoh, if you don't relent and let my people go, the firstborn son of every household in Egypt will die. That sounds pretty harsh to me. I don't like the idea that, okay, this God of love, this God that I believe in, like, is this, it seems incongruent to me. Like, that's a difficult thing to swallow. But here's what's happening. Remember at the beginning of Moses' story, when Pharaoh said that every Hebrew boy will die. He gave no one an out. There was no grace in this. Moses survives through these crazy circumstances, but God is demonstrating his superiority to Pharaoh. He's saying to Pharaoh, you are not God. I am God. But what God does is he gives them an out. He says, every household that puts the blood of a sacrificial lamb over their doorpost, it's not about the blood, it's about the statement of faith that I am God. Every household that does that will be passed over. Judgment will pass over their household. And God gives them this opportunity. As they put this sign of faith over their door, judgment will pass them by and they'll live. When the plague comes, they'll live. And the idea of this Passover becomes a really critical concept throughout the rest of the Bible, really the rest of the story. Of course, Pharaoh refuses to let God's people go, and the events unfold just like Moses said they would. And on that night, the firstborn of every household, Egyptian or not, without the sign over their doorway, the firstborn son dies. I can envision a lot of the miraculous things that happen in the Bible. Like I can envision being on the ark. I can envision parting of the Red Sea. You know, I can kind of get my head around what that might have been like. But this right here, I can't get my mind around what that would be like if that happened today in our day. Like I can't really comprehend it. But this is what happens. And those who put their trust in the God of Moses, the I Am, are spared the grief. Now, Moses' story is long and a lot of other great things happen, but we're going to stop right here at this point. It's been 430 years since Joseph's family first came to Egypt. That's a long time. They've multiplied. Historians say there's probably 2 to 3 million of them, roughly, in the nation of Israel. They've gone from being Joseph's family to being an actual nation. God is building something here. I hope you read it this week. A lot of crazy things happen, but I just want to close by just talking about two things, the upper story and the lower story. What's happening right now? In the internal spectrum of God's big story, something significant and beautiful is happening right here. This plague that happened at the Passover is unbelievably terrifying and horrible on the one hand, the death of the firstborn throughout the land of Egypt, but it's also unbelievably beautiful on the other hand, because what's happening is God is saying, judgment will pass over you simply through faith, simply by believing in me, simply by making just a statement of faith, not through any merit of your own, but believe in me and judgment will pass you by. It's not a question of moral superiority or religious behavior. It's simply a question of their faith. In John's gospel, the first chapter, we see John the Baptist teaching some of his pupils, and Jesus shows up. He comes by, and John says to his students, he says, "Look, the Lamb of God, who takes away the sins of the world. Behold the Lamb of God." And so what we see at the Passover in Moses' day is actually a foreshadowing of God's plan for redemption through Christ. He's showing us, he's demonstrating how judgment will pass us over because of the sacrifice of Christ, and we'll be reconciled to God through faith. We're still 1,500 years away from Jesus at the time of Moses, but that's what's happening in the upper story. It's beautiful. There's no way they could have known that's what was happening at that point, but looking back now, it's amazing. It's incredible. But on a ground level, just right here in my life, you know, what can I learn from Moses? What can I observe from his story that would just mold me into the more of the person that God created me to be? And the truth is, there's a lot of things. But I just want to point out one thing about Moses that happens to be true of almost every principal figure in the Bible. We see it over and over and over again. And that's that God doesn't make a habit of using people who are highly self-sufficient. He makes a habit of using people who are highly God-dependent, regardless of their personal self-belief. They might be incredibly personally secure or incredibly insecure. That's not really an important issue to God. What's important is, are they dependent on me? Those are the people that God uses. In fact, what we see is that people with a high level of self-belief often end up being the adversaries of God. That's usually more of a hindrance than it is a help to them when it comes to finding their role in God's story. So we think about Moses. He doesn't belong anywhere. He's kind of Hebrew, but not really. He's kind of a prince, but not really. And then he's in this nomadic country, and he's not really one of them either. And then he has to come back and lead the people, but he's not really a leader. And oh, by the way, he's a murderer. Think about if Moses was a capable, charismatic speaker, debater, orator, and he had enough faith in his own abilities to think that he could convince Pharaoh. Well, we see how hard-hearted Pharaoh is. It wouldn't have worked. It would have failed. The lesson we see in Moses' life is pretty simple. He's a success story because of one thing, his dependence on God. And I'm just here to tell you, if you're at a spot right now in life where Maybe things are going great, maybe they're going poorly, but if you find yourself in a position where your only choice is to depend on God, that might feel like you're in a real pinch, but that's probably the best place you can be in.